Congratulations, David. I mean, it's been such a pleasure and a privilege to be in on the genesis of this book over the years, as you've given lectures from it, from your materials, and particularly to be in on the genesis of a book that's very much about the genesis of books. Mm. I mean, that's my angle this evening. I haven't told you yet, but now you know. I think it goes without saying that a book like David's is of fascination to J.M. Coetzee's scholars. But for me, the fascination's been, since I heard you at that very first lecture that Lucy organized, the Shock Tower lecture on Master of Petersburg, my fascination has been how you've excavated this authorship. I mean, it's J.M. Coetzee's authorship, a very distinguished authorship, but in excavating that one particular authorship, you've uncovered and revealed so much about how we get to tell great stories, and about the life of writing, about fictional practice. And a great authorship has to start somewhere. So I wondered if you could read that epigraph from one of your chapters and then comment on this notion of J.M. Coetzee having a day one when he sat down to write.
Thanks, Fanula. Is this mic working? Before I do that, Fanula, thanks very much for hosting this discussion and for doing all these preparations, not least for reading the book in advance, and for the very kind introduction. And thanks to all of you for coming. It's wonderful to see you here. I said to Vanula, I was expecting about six people, mainly my family, but it's wonderful to have you all here. So the epigraph to chapter 3 that Vanula wants me to read comes from one of John Coetzee's notebooks. It's a piece that was written, I need to look up the footnote to check, but I think it was written into the notebook to Waiting for the Barbarian, so his third novel, in about 1978. But the note reads, "Every morning since the 1st of January 1970, I have sat down to write. I hate it."
Hate it with capital letters.
Hate is in capital letters, yes. So that tells us something about the genesis of this authorship and the quality of deliberation that is involved in his writing practice.
The lack of pleasure.
The self-scrutiny, the self-interrogation, the self-laceration that goes into his authorship so often, as well as the discipline and the determination. He refers to this date, the 1st of January 1970. He had been preparing himself to write fiction for a very long time, far longer than most novelists, I imagine, taking notes endlessly about the history of exploration at the Cape, doing a PhD in linguistics.
And they've been poems as well.
Yeah, absolutely. He had committed himself to the vocation of writer a long time before, but he didn't quite know what that meant. And for a long time it was going to be poetry, it wasn't going to be prose at all. When he decided on prose, then he embarked on this long preparation, excessively long preparation. And then he wrote a PhD dissertation on Samuel Beckett, and he was in the field of stylistics. He was trying to work out from Beckett's style whether he could explain why, just from the style alone, whether he could explain why Beckett switched from English to French. So,
but I mean, there's this huge discipline in his preparation and his scholarship, and I noticed, I mean, just for this 1st of January, I mean, most writers would probably take New Year's Day off, and I noticed in some of the other notebook entries you quote, it's Christmas Day, or there doesn't seem to be a holiday.
There's never a day off, no, absolutely. So on this particular day, it's uncomplicated in a way, it's a New Year's resolution. He decides in the year that he turns 30.
And he's not in South Africa.
He's not in South Africa. He's at 24 Parker Avenue in Buffalo, New York, on the 1st of January. So it was freezing cold. And he decides on that day, the first day of the year in which he will turn 30, that he can procrastinate no longer. So he has two children at that point. He decides to lock himself in the basement, which is clearly unheated because he puts on a coat and boots. And he is going to write 1,000 words. And he tells himself he's going to write 1,000 words every day until he has managed. The word count quickly comes down, but the resolution pretty much held firm for the next 50 years.
I just want to ask you one self-reflexive question about your own authorship. I'm not going to go too much into it, but was there a day one for you in writing this particular study? Because it seems a departure. I understand that you grew up on the style of scholarship which says that biography is irrelevant to literary criticism. Mm. So when was your Road to Damascus experience? When was your 1st of January 1970?
It wouldn't have been a single day, but it was a period of a couple of weeks. I was in Stockholm on a visiting fellowship there, and I had decided that I would use this time to read a lot of Dostoevsky, because I hadn't done that before. I hadn't had the opportunity to do that before, and I wanted to do that, again, a kind of preparation, so that for the first time I could engage properly with this novel, The Master of Petersburg, which I think is his most difficult text. And I'd always postponed dealing with it because I knew I had to read Dostoevsky and work hard at explaining exactly what the relationship with, finding out what the relationship with Dostoevsky was. So over a couple of weeks, I immersed myself in this text. But the backstory to that, or rather immersed myself in Dostoevsky's writing, but the backstory to that period is that John Coetzee's Dutch publisher, Eva Cossé, asked me to write a biography when she published Summertime. I think we all know that Summertime is a bizarre account of his own personal life. It's an autobiography that takes the form of a biography in the making, being written by an English biographer, Vincent. That is the surname, but clearly the name suggests conqueror. So this is John Coetzee's preemptive strike against biographies being written about him, essentially. But because it is so inventive and playful with his own biography, Eva Cossé, in a very clever commission, asked me to write a biography that could be published alongside it, so the readers could tell what the difference was between fact and fiction. So I thought, oh, this is interesting, and I toyed with the idea. The problem was that I'm not a biographer, and so I felt anxious in the face of this commission. And anyway, I was too busy to do it, but we kept in communication, and we kept talking about it. Eventually, I thought, well, the kind of biography I could possibly write would be something very strongly themed, and I thought I might write a biography about his relationship to the political. Which is a theme that I'd worked on before, and so we agreed that I would write a book called A Political Life, James Coetzee, A Political Life. And I had in mind James Nolson's biography of Beckett, which is called Damned to Fame. So the idea was, whether he likes it or not, Coetzee is forced into dealing with political questions. So that discomfort was going to be the basis of that narrative. Then, however, we discovered that John Kahneman was writing a biography. And so we agreed that the sensible thing to do would be to wait to see what John Kahneman came up with, to get in communication with John Kahneman, to work together. We met with John Coetzee about this, and John Coetzee was very astute. He said, if there's going to be a race to the finish with two biographies being written, then everybody's going to lose. He was absolutely right about that, and he encouraged us to contact John Kahneman, so we did. And John Kahneman and I got on extremely well. He was very polite and courteous. The first time we met, we had this fabulous meal of oxtail and red wine in the middle of the day at Meerplanshof in Stellenbosch. The meal lasted for hours and hours. We had lots to talk about, and then we hit it off, I think. And we agreed that I would read his manuscript and he would read mine, but I would wait until he finished the book to see what possibly could be done after he'd written his biography. And very sadly, tragically, in fact, John Connemara died so soon after finishing his biography that I feel that the communication, the correspondence, the nascent friendship is sort of unfinished. But it was clear to me that once he had finished, that by his own admission, he's interested in the life of John Connemara. What I wanted to do is, because I'm a literary critic rather than a biographer, I wanted to do something that emphasized the work a little more. So I was beginning to put aside this notion of a political life, and because of John Connemara's particular emphasis, tried to tilt the discussion towards the novels themselves. Then the crucial development was that John Connemara's manuscripts and papers became available in the public domain for the first time. And I went to Texas to read them. And then, you know, that was my genesis moment, if you like. Light bulbs went off, and it was clear to me that what I had to do, which is to explore this incredible creative process that goes into the making of these amongst our most treasured South African fictions. And what a privilege and pleasure it was to work through these papers, to see all the vulnerabilities, all the insecurity, the autobiography that underlies the fiction in every case. He just turns out to be a very different author from the author that I had come to know and respect from the public work. So this was telling me something about authorship itself under South African conditions, and that was the story that I decided I had to tell.
I feel that it's a wonderful book because you can read it as a scholar, or as simply the common reader of J.M. Coetzee's novels. But for me, there's also a way of cutting across the chapters and seeing the process of writing, the habits and routines, to see maybe the typical genesis of a J.M. Coetzee novel. I mean, possibly I'm oversimplifying, but well, if you bear with me, would it be true to say that a J.M. Coetzee novel begins with, I think the word you use is a provocation?
Yes.
Something like grief. I mean, if you could just turn to that photograph of Nicholas Coetzee, that beautiful picture where he's just, I mean, of all the images in it's a beautifully illustrated book, but that young man looking out at the camera in that way and knowing that that his Coetzee's son has died tragically, and then you're able to track how that grief provoked Master of Peace, or is that a simplification?
No, I think it's absolutely right. And I started with Master of Petersburg not only because I had written about it before, and because I was telling myself if I could manage to write something about this book, then I can apply the same approach to the other novels, to the rest of the earth. So I wanted to reassure myself that I could tackle the most difficult material before I tackle the rest of the book. And I think as Cape Town people all know, John's son Nicholas died under extremely painful and tragic and difficult circumstances. And I think that there's been the fact that the novel is a response to that death has been well known for quite some time. But exactly how that response formed has been a mystery for all of us, including myself. So I wanted to go into this. And what I learned from the manuscripts and by reading the novel carefully against Dostoevsky was that John Coetzee places his own grief in the hands of, in the vessel, if you like, which is the metaphor I use, in the vessel of Dostoevsky's creativity. So he imagines Dostoevsky writing a great novel in response to a situation in which he's lost a beloved stepson. Although when the manuscript starts, it's not a stepson, it's a son. So he imagines Dostoevsky losing a son, later a stepson, and writing a novel in response to that situation. So he displaces his own grief, if you like, into this work of historical fiction, which makes it a work of autobiographical historical fiction, if you can imagine such a construct. But there's no doubt that it is a response to Nicholas's death. We were not sure about that, but it's clear that it was.
And he seems to be aware of that in a very self-critical way, that he may be exploiting his own son's death. There's a quote, and I'm not sure, actually, I'm such a poor reader, I'm not sure whether it comes from Nicholas or from a character in the novel or a character in Dostoevsky. People pay my father a lot of money to write novels, something like that.
Yeah.
As if the son is aware that the very novel that he's going to be placed in, that his own death is going to be placed in, is going to earn money.
Yes, although how much money was earned out of The Master of Petersburg, such a difficult and strange book, I'm not sure. But certainly John Crissier is troubled by his own project, troubled enough by his own project to tell himself that he's got to find a way of allowing Nicholas's own voice and presence to contradict the voice and the presence of the author. So the difficulty that he faced was to create the kind of text in which Nicholas could introduce a kind of rupture into the text. I mean, how you do that with deliberation and intention, how you create with intention a structure, a fictional structure, in which the subject of your writing can interrupt what you're doing. That was key to the development of the novel. But if you don't mind, I want to read a couple of paragraphs from manuscript material that did not make it into the final novel, which I found so exquisitely beautiful, if you don't mind. It's material that shows the extent to which Nicholas's presence is in the book. He was writing this a year or so after Nicholas died. A turn of the head, the line of an eyebrow, a figure disappearing around the corner. In all these, I mistake you, and my heart lifts for a moment. Lifts as a wave does, then goes down again. Mistaken, taken by the wrong thing, taken in, like an abandoned lover catching glimpses everywhere of the lip, the eye of the woman who abandoned him. What was one has become distributed. The beloved is everywhere, scattered, fragments of the beloved body, torn up like the body of Osiris, of Orpheus, young men who had too much, glowing, Doré, Chrysos, golden-bodied. Now a matter of gathering together the golden hoard, putting together the scattered parts, assembling the broken body in its perfection again. Poetry is the listing the parts so that the eye leaving the page will for an instant have before it the image of the whole body resurrected. The challenge in this book was to depersonalize it. But of course that's the challenge of all of the fiction, was to find a way of writing himself out of the story. But in this particular book, he makes that task about as difficult as you can imagine. I mean, how do you write a depersonalized novel about an author who is writing a novel in response to the death of a son? Was almost impossible. But that was the project that he had set himself. He makes himself as vulnerable as possible and then sets about writing himself out of the story. So a passage like that doesn't make it in the end once the structure has fallen into place. And the shift from writing about a son to writing about a stepson is part of that, but there was so much else involved.
But before we get to those shifts, because I'm still tracking, we've got the provocation, and then it seems to me that quite soon after the provocation, there is a sketched outline of a proposed novel that is almost certainly unusable as blurb material for the final published novel. And I wondered if you could read on page 218 the notebook entry from 1994, which shows the genesis of Disgrace. Just so that people, because I'm sure everyone here has read Disgrace, to hear, you'll have to have a magnifying glass, by the way.
218.
Yeah. It's that little photograph that you've got of the text. And maybe tell us a bit about the actual notebooks that you were reading in Austin where you found this material.
This is one of the many astonishing discoveries in the papers. Who would have believed given the state of criticism of Disgrace, which so often denies the fact that it's locally referenced. You know, no, this is not a novel about the TRC. There's a profound critique of the TRC here, etc., etc., if at all, etc., etc. Well, this is how it started. This is the notebook entry that is the seed of Disgrace. A man at the prime of his career, a respected writer, is invited onto a truth commission. He declines. He says no one is morally competent to sit in judgment. His private motive is the knowledge that he is not morally competent, or, capital O-R, or is guilty and may be found out. He has seduced a student. She is about to denounce him. Blackmail? ? His daughter, her clear eyes. That was the seed of Disgrace. So a very very clear provocation, a very local, a very topical one. And that, of course, is very surprising, given the literariness of that book, its dependence on Byron, David Lurie writing this peculiar opera, etc., etc., which has meant that the book is drawn into metafictional discussion across the world. But, you know, this is where it started, a very distinct South African provocation.
And you make the point, I mean, we began the discussion with Master of Petersburg, the book about the son, and Disgrace being the book about the daughter.
Yes, absolutely. And these two projects are linked, because he writes that note about Disgrace in 94. I was absolutely amazed to see how early he started writing that novel. 13th of December, 94, the year of the elections. I do know that for a while he had been intrigued by the idea of a novel based on a man's public humiliation, that idea appealed to him. So he'd been waiting for the right context in which to write that story. And the TRC seems to have given it to him. Now, why did he take such a peculiar angle on those events? I think it's because he had been so deeply immersed in a Dostoevskian world. The Master of Petersburg is the previous novel, and it's published in the same year, in 1994. So he's continuing, in a way, with this very skeptical treatment of the moral psychology of those who are involved in political projects. So the triumphalist moment in South Africa, for him, this is what it takes to be a great author. The triumphalist moment in South Africa is exactly the moment when you want to write a novel about a man's public humiliation because he can't live up to the moral climate around him. It's a strategically fantastic intervention. Yeah.
And then following that provocation and the sketched outline, I think most want-to-be writers would be able to come up with those two elements. But I think the departure for Coetzee, what sets him apart from everybody else, is what follows. And that's the drafting and the redrafting, the multiple drafts, the determination, even as he's hating it with capital letters. And he's waiting for something. But let's just linger with him while he's waiting. If you could read the original opening for Waiting for the Barbarians on page 109. He seems to be just endlessly trying things out.
The astonishing thing about Waiting for Barbarians, I mean, the distinctive feature of this novel, as we all know, is the displacement of the milieu onto this fictional empire, this empire of no time and no place. From the manuscripts, we find out that, in fact, the material, the geography, the vocabulary, the diet, the landscape description were all taken from descriptions of 19th century Western Asia, China, Mongolia. So he was using the geography of that region and its history to create the milieu, but but of course without specifying what he
was
doing.
But it's almost like he's trying to force himself not to write about the Karoo.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course the Karoo is in there, nevertheless, as well. I mean, it's Mongolia sort of overshadowed with, or underpinned maybe,
Prince
with
Albert.
Prince Albert. Yeah, absolutely right. But it started as a novel about Cape Town. And this was not the first time, and it wouldn't be the last time, that he would write a novel about Cape Town undergoing a revolution. So he starts The Waiting for the Barbarians as follows. From the open window of the guard room, Manos Millis, Greek name, Greek South African protagonist, who eventually becomes a magistrate in the novel, unnamed, but for the moment is named, Manos Millis watched the refugees trudge up the road that led from the jetty to the prison gates. The launch that had brought them was already halfway back to the mainland. It was plain that the crew were not talking to the people they had ferried, otherwise who would come? Grass, thistles, clover had grown in the courtyard, splitting the flagstones. Mice had run in the corridors. In the toilet bowls, the water had dried up, leaving rings of rust. The only sound had been the cry of birds. Pigeons shipped caked the window ledges. Gulls swooped into the courtyard at dusk. In his lodge, the watchman drank himself to sleep. So what's happening there is in a style of naturalism, which Alex Laguma had used, and before them, the great realist novelists. We were talking about Dreiser last night, Theodore Dreiser, but also Emil Zola. But he was writing in that style about Cape Town, an exhausted Cape Town after a revolutionary war. And the setting here is Robben Island. The island is no longer a prison, it's an embarkation station for whites who are leaving the country in ships chartered by the UN. And there's a kind of stasis because the UN and the local government refuse to pay for the fuel. So everybody's trapped. Wonderful stuff.
Yeah.
So anyway, this manuscript is paralyzed. He can't get it to work. And he writes abandoned across the bottom.
Yeah, I was going to ask you what these pages look like. He doesn't ever scrumple anything up and throw it away.
He doesn't scrumple it up, no. And it's clearly not been retrieved from the waste paper basket, file 13. He keeps the manuscripts that are abandoned.
Because he's fascinated by his own process.
Absolutely. And documents and records everything. Maybe we should talk about that as well. But these particular early drafts of Waiting for Barbarians have big letters written, sort of, you know, a half an inch high, abandoned in big black marker pen. And then he starts with the same material and the same situation, but it's from a slightly different angle. He tries to get the story to work. And the core of the story is about a relationship, rather like Disgrace later, a relationship between an older man and a younger woman. There's a lot of aggressive, in fact, there's a lot of aggressive sex in this relationship, as if the restlessness and the aggression of the culture is coming out in their sexuality. That's what he was trying to do, and I think the model was Robert Musil, who writes in a similar style. So this is the story and the situation, and it's not working. He can't find, the situation is interesting, but there's no narrative, really. So there's no momentum, so he abandons it all. And it's only when he begins to shift the milieu completely into this unspecific place that the narrative begins to take off. When that happens, in the middle of that activity, Steve Biko is murdered in detention. And he collects press clippings from the Cape Times about the inquest. And he starts writing a story of torture into this detached milieu. So it's both a simultaneous displacement from South Africa, but also the narrative is energized by local events. So it's both a homecoming and a displacement, and it's out of that creativity that the novel eventually gets.
And all of this is documented, and does he keep the newspaper clippings as well? They're all
newspaper
there.
Newspaper clippings are there. The manuscripts record the process. There's also a little notebook that he carries around with him, I think. My assumption was, and he's got a way of recording something when he's not sitting at his desk writing. And those notebooks, if you put the notebooks together with the manuscripts, you can work out what the narrative is.
And I mean, it's so exhaustive, this process of writing versions of a story until he finds the right one, that you're kind of thinking that what keeps him going is he's fascinated by the process of telling a story rather than by the story itself.
Yeah, absolutely. And not only fascinated by it, but he believes in it. Because he doesn't know where these stories are going. And he's got a very astute sense of what's going to work and what's not going to work. So he will abandon something quite quickly if it's not working out. But he has absolute faith in the creative process, in the fact that somewhere, if he just writes, even if he finds the material he's writing to be to be inadequate, he will just press on in the hope that at some point, some spark will happen that he can recognize as the authentic note. That one authentic note, that's the note he's after in his writing as well. And he's got an incredibly sure hand and eye to identify when that note arises, and then he will pick that up.
Now, I know you keep wanting to get to that triumphant moment, but there's a lot that happens before, and in many, not particularly in Waiting for the Barbarians, but in many of the manuscripts, there's an early moment, I think, of what you call thin fictionalizing, where he is thinly fictionalizing autobiography. And something has to happen to turn, for example, Vera Kutsia, his mother in Age of Iron, to how she gets turned into Mrs. Karen, or Michael Kay starts off as some kind of intellectual or academic. I mean, how does he get to be?
That is a particularly bizarre situation and a complete turnaround in the material. He came home from a long sabbatical in 1979, which he spent at Berkeley and at Texas, and he was reading linguistics and also finishing Waiting for the Barbarians while he was traveling. He came back, and I think around about October of 1979, and from what I can work out, he had been burgled. And a particularly bad burglary, with the house having been vandalized and so forth. So he records the idea for a novel because he's not surprised that this has happened, but nevertheless he's angry. So he begins writing a novel about a man of liberal conscience, this is the way it's put, who calls in the police, but the police are not interested in dealing with this burglary. They're much more interested in keeping the lid on the angry classes to deal with white middle class victims of crime. But he begins to lose it completely, and he goes into the townships and he posts posters looking for the criminal wanted, you know. And then he looks for, this is something else, it's part of the structure, part of the process, he looks for a suitable text in the canon generally that he can use as a kind of intertext to work off as he develops the project. In this case, the intertext is Heinrich von Kleist's novel, Michael Kohlhaas. That is the source of Michael Kay. It's not Kafka, it's von Kleist. Kafka comes into it, Kafka's not irrelevant, but that was the original provocation. So he uses this novel as a way of structuring a novel about a man who undertakes a sort of violent insurrection out of pure anger because he senses there's been an injustice done to him, which is what Kleist's novel is about. But that is a long way from the novel that he ends up publishing, right? I mean, Michael Kay is not an intellectual, he's not white, he's not middle class, far from it, he's the exact opposite, in fact. He's an underclass South African who's inarticulate, he's not an intellectual at all. So how does Kutsia get to that particular protagonist? Well, that's the story.
Yes, so I wanted you to tell that story about, because you put it so well, what the exact parallels are between this coloured male, C.M. Gardner,
and
no fixed address, living in an electrical box, it seems, and how, and the similarities between him and Kutsia himself.
Yes. This is partly why I say that so much of the writing is actually autobiography, although we've suppressed that knowledge, I think. But if you think about it, Michael Kay is a lot like Kutsia.
He's got this quietist sort of
this temperament. Quietism, you're absolutely right. He has this rather strange dietary habits. He's a very strong bond with the mother. He's very ascetic. Loves the Karoo. You know, in fact, it's John Kutsia in many ways.
Yeah. So you've called these sudden breakthroughs that happen after what seems to be almost the tedium of writing and rewriting.
Yeah.
You've called them the writing event. A writing event happens, and that's a breakthrough, and it's, as you've said, it's often associated with some kind of misfictional accommodation. And that reaching out, he seems to reach out into his extensive classical reading and manages to find himself. Because one of the repeated, I love the quotations such as, is there room for me and my history in this book? He's asking himself these questions while writing. If not, what am I doing? When am I going to enter?
Yes.
And then when Michael Kay changes, he says, finally, perhaps, evidence of me.
Exactly.
So
that modernist orthodoxy that those of us who teach literature are still stuck in, which is all about the separation of the author from the character, we're going to have to rethink this. Because on the evidence of the notebooks, he wants himself to appear in the work somehow. And until he reaches, he gets to a point where the structure of feeling that's driving the novel forward is something that he can own personally. And so it's linked to authorial desire, the project's not going to work. So there might be another stage at which you want to say, okay, you know, he does write himself out eventually, but in order to get there, he needs to be absolutely invested in it. So that's what's going on.
Will you read this?
Yeah.
I'm just so fascinated by all this behind-the-scenes stuff.
Right.
And I can't...
What page?
I'm so blind, I can't see what my page... 139.
Okay.
Can you find that paragraph that begins, the notebook is illuminating here?
Right. The notebook is illuminating here because it shows that Coetzee is frequently anxious about attaining consciousness, and attaining consciousness is in quotes. He writes, "The problem that torments Kay on the mountainside... how am I going to prove my innocence? That equals, how am I going to tell my story? Equals, how am I going to find a voice? Equals, how am I going to attain consciousness in this book?" Unquote. Attaining consciousness means two things: showing that one properly understands one's own materials, and bearing witness to one's existence in the act of writing. And that's how I interpret that. So, I mean, for those of us who are literary critics, I mean, you know, we've been so mesmerized by the metafictional qualities of Coetzee's fiction. That is to say, the extent to which it is writing about writing. And the fact that it has this metafictional dimension has fueled truckloads of criticism, right? But what we discover in these papers is the existential compulsion behind the metafiction. He's not just playing intellectual games. It's not about borrowing a quotation from some author and then spinning out a novel on the basis of it. People do make that assumption. It couldn't be more wrong. Instead, the metafiction is about understanding his relationship to the material. And that relationship is an historical one. So it's a case of testifying to your existence in the book, your historical existence, but through the book. So the metafiction is a profoundly existential act. And you know, this changes the way we think about postmodern self-reflexivity. You know, it's about investing yourself where you are, which is why I tried to, that's what I'm trying to capture by calling, by giving the subtitle of the book, Face to Face with Time, which is a quotation from Life and Times of Michael Kay, but it seems to resonate with the fiction generally.
So this notoriously impersonal writer, this follower of T.S. Eliot, is me, me, I. Where's the space for me?
Yeah.
And I think something else that struck me about this drafting stage is the intense self-critique. It's another element that I think very few writers are capable of. There's too much, I think people take too much pleasure in what they've drafted. And he's almost harsh with himself, and he seems to be having an ongoing battle with realism.
Yes.
And that's, he's just not satisfied with realism, and he's not satisfied with the idea of tying meaning up neatly into parcels which are handed out to readers. Yeah. He wants to complicate it. And
well, I think that the distrust of realism, it's a bit like Brecht in a sense. It's a distrust of being so distracted by the momentum of the story that the gravitas of the situation is lost, because he does want that, what I call its existential dimension. He wants to feel that he is somehow testifying to his existence through the book. I mean, that's how you increase the stakes of novel writing, right? If you feel that your mortality is on the line somehow, then that's going to change the degree of seriousness that you bring to bear on the writing process. If you think about a phrase that it's not I don't think it's one of his most successful novels, Slow Man, but there is this very interesting moment when Elizabeth Costello, the novelist, berates the character Paul Raymond or Raymond by saying, "Push the mortal envelope. Push the mortal envelope. Justify your existence." There's something of that in all the writing, but he's not happy until he's pushed it that far. So, if the novel takes off and there's a realist narrative there that is sort of self-generating, he becomes very uncomfortable, because that serious, there's no room for that kind of seriousness anymore. So he thinks about adding more layers of self-consciousness, you know, putting it into a frame in which some author is present. That's the typical move. So he's always resisting the story he's telling in some way.
But what seems to work for him more than putting in layers, which I think he quite rightly resists, is deleting. And yes. I mean, it's fascinating. I mean, you've mentioned the deleting of the sex scenes in Waiting for the Barbarians, yeah. which seemed to embarrass you. We were all keen to go and read them so we can see what embarrassed you. But I was thinking about his deletion also of the language experiments in Foe, where he experiments with different ways in which Friday might speak and then decides against it, and how thoroughly unrealistic the ending of Foe is. And I can't help thinking that must have been very satisfying to him to get to that point.
Yeah, satisfying, but also very, very problematic, I think, and difficult, and very provocative and controversial. The silencing of Friday is something that is really very striking, especially if you see what Friday's genesis involves. You know, it's quite clear that Friday is a representative of an African voice and identity. Coetzee was not in any kind of ambivalence about that. From the novel, you're not quite sure. But if you trace the process, it's clear that that's what he was thinking. And of course, he had taught African studies at State University of New York at Buffalo, completely immersed in Fanon and Aimé Césaire and so on and so forth. So then he comes back to South Africa and he's wondering how he's going to locate himself in African studies, teaching in Cape Town. At any rate, when he's writing Foe, which one of the titles for that book was going to be Friday, by the way, so it's clear that Friday is at the center of that novel. But the representation of Friday in the early stages is all about trying to give Friday an appropriate voice. And there's some hilarious scenes. And Friday in Robinson Crusoe is awful because he speaks this very subservient kind of English. And Coetzee wants to undermine that somehow. So he gives Friday a lot of mimicry, and Friday spends a lot of time parodying Susan Barton. But it's still not working. So he reaches a point when he feels that he's got to silence Friday by having his tongue severed. And he knows that by doing that, he is the author doing it, right? So he is responsible for severing Friday's tongue. He knows that this will be a controversial thing to do. The way I read it is that he is writing into the novel at that point his own sense of disablement about being silenced in the presence of the post-colonial affirmation that he can't represent that space, that voice, that identity. And it's actually the author's silence that is being registered in the silence of Friday.
Age of Iron was called The House on Toll Road.
The House on Toll Road, which is where he lived. It was also called Winter at one stage. It was also called Rule of Iron, and then eventually Age of Iron. Yeah.
And was Dustlands called Lies?
Dustlands was called Lies. Yes.
Which
is very
telling.
Where
did your fictional career?
Yeah, I mean, he starts right on that 1st of January 1970. What does he start with? What's his subject material, his matter? His subject matter is his own historical identity. He starts writing about his ancestors, right? And he calls this text Lies. So he's writing in Buffalo, New York, you know, it's the middle of winter, but he's projecting himself into the Karoo, the warmth of the Karoo, and the familiarity of it, and the coziness of it. But he's also wanting to deal with the fact that he feels betrayed by his origins. And so, you know, the idea of writing about these lies that he grew up with is point of departure. Mm. Yeah.
And I feel that in the notebooks there is a constant awareness and to the point of fear about critical reception. Almost as if he is reading as if he were the harshest possible South African literary critic. And sometimes he seems to be trying to predict what Nadine Gordimer will say.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, one of the surprising aspects to all of this is the respect for Nadine Gordimer. I was astonished to find that he goes to the Lilly Library at the University of Indiana at Bloomington to read Nadine Gordimer's notebooks when he is preparing to write The Lives of Animals. He's beginning to think about disgrace at the same time.
So she is, to some extent, Elizabeth Costello. She's providing
some... There's no doubt. And there are other... You know, I think she's also Vera Kutsia, to some extent, plus him. You know. But Nadine Gordimer's public persona is in there, definitely. He's definitely thinking about Gordimer some of the time when he's writing Costello. So when he and Gordimer disagree, it affects him very deeply because of that respect. And he writes about this quite frankly in the manuscript material of quite a few of the novels actually. So her very critical review of Michael Kay is one of the things that he goes back to several times. It marked him quite deeply. And for me, the sadness of that particular episode is that when he was writing Michael Kay, he anticipated her criticism. Or he anticipated that criticism of that kind would come. Because he said several times during the drafting of the novel, when is Michael Kay going to start shooting? You know, he's got to become an activist. He's got to make peace with violence. Otherwise, this is going to look like a novel that just justifies quietism.
Because he's drawing on the Kamiskruin killer that he's
cut out of. The Kamiskruin killer is part of it, yeah. And he kept a photograph of the news coverage of the Kamiskruin killer, who was a sort of Michael Kay character who descended on Kamiskruin and started killing people. And at one point, Michael Kay was going to be a bandit who came out of Fernandendal and started mowing people down in Greater. So that when he becomes quietistic, which is the direction that the creative process was taking him, Kutsi became more and more anxious that he was becoming less of an activist. And so he was very concerned about that. And isn't it then tragic that having lifted Michael Kay into a kind of higher being through some very interesting reading, by the way, he was reading novels that enabled him to do that, but also he was reading theology that enabled him to transform Michael Kay into a different kind of prodigy, a different symbol altogether. So he was working hard to turn Michael Kay to something else. But he was, because he was conscious that if he was allowed to just be a kind of failed political activist, then it'd be in for all kinds of criticism. And goodness me, what happens? Nadine Gordimer says, he's not enough of an activist. No. I mean, that's very sad, actually. The other moment is when they disagreed publicly over the Rushdie business in Cape Town. At the time, he said everything that audience wanted to hear, which was a difficult argument to reconstruct, but essentially it was about the audience objecting to the fact that Rushdie had been disinvited, in other words, had been censored, when the whole point was a discussion of censorship. And he came out with this purist position and a critique of Kosor and the Weekly Mail and the left and of Gordimer herself for acquiescing in censorship because they should have had Rushdie there. Right. But in retrospect, particularly after the fatwa, because this is just before the fatwa, after the fatwa he changed his opinion and he thought, well, actually now we know how serious these people are and that Rushdie might not have been safe, and that Gordimer, in her political wisdom, understood that. So he backed off and he acknowledged that she was probably correct.
What, was it also in the Austin papers that you discovered that he had once applied to become a censor himself?
Yes. Yes. I wasn't the first person to make that discovery. That was Peter MacDonald, who wrote this gorgeous book, which I strongly recommend to everybody, called The Literature Police, which is an account of the censorship archives. What I discovered was that he had been writing a novel about censorship called The Burning of the Books. So, I mean, here's an unrealized novel that I found in the papers. So he writes Dustlands, and then he starts writing this new manuscript, and it's called The Burning of the Books, about a man whose job it is to censor the literature in all the libraries, especially the university libraries. So he's got a big stamp that says Goedgekeur, and he stamps the books that are going to get through. The rest he puts in a truck, and he goes down to the foreshore, and he burns them in an incinerator. Incineration of books leading to disgrace. I mean, it's clear that the incineration of books, there's a famous poem by Heinrich Heine about this. If you burn books, you end up burning people. I mean, that was the trajectory of this novel. But the novel didn't work out. But anyway, he's writing this manuscript for nearly a year, and then he abandons it because it's not working out. It's when he stops writing that novel that he applies to be a censor. That's what Peter didn't know. So it looks as if he applied to be a censor because he was wanting to do a bit of research.
Could you tell the story of how a censor's report ended up as being the blurb on the back of In the Heart of the Country?
Absolutely.
The wonderful chain of events. Anna M. Lowe.
Anna M. Lowe was one of the censors who read In the Heart of the Country. In fact, Herman discovered this story. Herman is sitting at the back of there. Anna Lowe was one of the censors who read the manuscript of In the Heart of the Country, but she was completely won over, as she should have been, by the extraordinary qualities of this text. But then, I suppose in what is a rather lazy fashion, when the novel was published, she turned her censor's report, which was very complimentary, into a review of the novel. And then when the novel was republished, the publishers, and I think if I'm not mistaken, Raven Press itself, used a quotation from this review,
which was
for a cover shot on the novel. So the censor's report actually enters the very publication of the novel. But you know, it's an extraordinary story. I mean, part of the story here is that his own work escaped censorship largely because the censors could not fail to be impressed by the quality of the writing. And what Peter MacDonald's study of censorship shows is that the censors who worked on literature were not just bureaucrats who made very stupid decisions. They were people who were interested in detecting, as they saw it, the quality of the writing. So Coetzee for them was first prize.
David, I want to end by asking you to offer a rebuttal to the London Review of Books. Thomas Meaney came out this week by saying, referring to the notebooks in Austin, Texas, they don't lead you to the work. They are scattered chicken feed for those foolish enough to come pecking in Texas.
Has he been there? Is there any indication that he's been?
Quotes. Some of the quotes that you quote. But I think it sounds like he just doesn't want people to go there.
Well, it's crazy. It's an absolutely bizarre statement. What I can tell you is that the University of the Harry Ransom Center, the reading room at the Harry Ransom Center, recently had six people working on the Coetzee papers at the same time. And that is a record for any of the authors in their manuscript collection. So this guy is swimming against the tide, because the consensus is that these papers are extraordinarily rich and interesting. But of course you need to know the fiction to be able to understand the process that leads up to them.
Otherwise you become the chicken.
Yeah.